I tried to do my homework well for the last couple of days and prepare detailed introductions for our speakers. And I'm afraid at this point in the program, my introduction looks a little silly. I don't think many of us care that Dr. Adams has been active as an economic consultant to our government on many occasions. It is important, and very important to us all, to note that for over 20 years, Dr. Adams has been an inspiring and dedicated professor of economics. He's been an extraordinary teacher. He's now an extraordinary president, and much more important than any of that, Walter Adams is an extraordinary human being.
Mr. Samet, Senator Hart, other distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, I have to deviate from my prepared remarks at the outset to welcome here today the Governor of the State of Michigan, the Honorable William Milliken. We are no longer alone. Indeed, some of us may quit this movement pretty soon because it's becoming too damn respectable. I want you to know at the outset, and I want Spiro Agnew to know that as always, my remarks are not dictated by Hanoi or Peking or Washington. My remarks this afternoon are dictated by personal conviction and conscience. I shall speak to you neither about the legality nor the morality of U.S. involvement in Vietnam, but concern myself exclusively with our national self-interest. I shall assess the impact of the war on this country in the clinically dispassionate parlance appropriate to cost-benefit calculations. And pose three essentially very simple questions. One, what does the U.S. have to gain from this venture? Two, what is the price we pay? And three, is the war worth this price? Now, my conclusion will be unmistakable. The Vietnam War is a national disaster, fought for ephemeral ends, and paid for with a depleted society. Commitment of additional resources will not retrieve this futile investment. Discretion and wisdom, therefore, militate toward immediate disengagement. And the redirection of our efforts to national priorities which better serve the national interest. Now, in this context, the Center of the Church of Idaho has said, Vietnam is a showcase of bankruptcy, a hopeless war fought for insubstantial stakes. As a war for high principle, Vietnam simply does not measure up. The Saigon government is neither a democracy warranting our support for on ideological grounds, nor a victim of international aggression warranting our support under the United Nations Charter. As an effort to contain Chinese power, the war in Vietnam is irrelevant as well as unsuccessful. Even if a communist Vietnam were to fall under Chinese control, as I do not think it would, the gains to China would be trivial compared with those accruing from her industrialization and acquisition of nuclear weapons. End of quote from Senator Church. Now let me underscore this point. We're wasting American lives and American treasure for a piece of real estate worthless to the defense of America. We're destroying a country in order to save it, ostensibly for principles which have no demonstrable relation to our national security. We are committing America to a fatal land war in Asia on the assumption that the Viet Cong must be beaten in their native boondocks before they can scramble ashore in Australia or San Francisco. Transported there, no doubt, by Hanoi's or Peking's invincible sampan navy. Now I say to you without qualification that even if the domino theory were correct, even if the loss of Vietnam would mean the communist conquest of all of Southeast Asia, which to me is speculative fabrication, I think our current position would be suicidal madness. Like ourselves, the communists would find this area to be an impoverished mass of humanity stirred by nationalist aspirations and embroiled in constant revolutionary turmoil, a burden rather than an asset. The lords of Peking, who lack the resources to lift their own country from the depths of underdevelopment, could hardly afford to subsidize the developmental effort of their potential satellites. Just as conquest of the area would be a Pyrrhic victory for the Chinese, so even a total U.S. victory would not contribute one iota to the security of our country or its geopolitical posture in the world. Moreover, the cost of attempting such a victory, or even maintaining a stalemate, would exact an intolerable price, not only in casualties and treasure, but in terms of the violence it does to the fabric of American society, the quality of American life, and the validity of the American dream. No nation has unlimited economic, human, intellectual, and spiritual resources. Even such affluent nations as the United States are not exempt from this universal law. This means that in striving to achieve its national goals, a country must make choices. It must arrange its objectives in some order of priority. an order which reflects its value system, its judgment as to what is more important and what is less important. The nation must then use its resources accordingly. Now I ask, how long will it take us to learn that the United States cannot afford to impose or police a Pax Americana on a global scale, even if it were desirable to do so? How much more experience do we need before we understand that we cannot annually divert 30 billions of our economic resources, as well as our intellectual energies, to an irrelevant war on the Asian mainland, while at the same time contributing to the defense of Western Europe, conquering the moon, participating in the armaments and missiles race, and maintaining a viable and just society at home? A choice between priorities is unavoidable. Should we indulge ourselves in the ideological luxuries of Vietnam, feeding the arrogance that goes with power, or should we put our own house in order, fight the war against poverty, deprivation, despair, and bigotry at home, before we attempt to deny an insignificant bit of territory to communist ambitions abroad, focusing on America's rational self-interest? The choice would seem to be too obvious for further debate. But contemplate some statistics. Because of our mistake in Vietnam, we're not building the 6 million housing units which the Riot Commission has recommended for America's ghettos. We cannot afford, it is said, the additional $6 billion to provide compensatory education for deprived and handicapped children. We cannot afford the $1.5 billion to provide the needed manpower training for the hardcore unemployed. We cannot afford the $5 billion for model cities or the $3 billion for community action programs under OEO. We cannot afford the $26 billion needed to rid our rivers and lakes of industrial and municipal waste. We cannot afford to restructure our welfare system through a negative income tax, which would cost some $15 billion. We cannot afford an efficient urban transit system, a program to combat environmental pollution, which may yet do us all in. And we cannot afford provision for adequate health care. Let me restate the same point differently. In the last decade, the federal government has spent 3 times more on Vietnam than on Medicare and medical assistance. 4 times more than on all levels of education, and 15 times more than on housing and community development. It has spent more on this war than it spent in our entire history on public higher education or police protection. It has spent more on Vietnam in each of the last three years than it would cost to operate 350 universities like Michigan State per year. Now get this, and Governor, I hope you listen to it too. Tuition free and at no cost to the taxpayers. I see now where your true sentiments lie. They're breadbasket. Now this, it seems to me, is not a rational allocation of national resources. When our cities are dying, 35 million Americans are living below the poverty level, our youth is alienated and disillusioned, our society is embittered by racial strife, and the American spirit is racked by confusion and doubt. I say this is not an acceptable performance record, and today's events, that is, this meeting and other meetings like this around the country, demonstrate that the American conscience no longer tolerates it. In conclusion, let me remind you that in 1789, our founding fathers created a new nation in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This has been the American dream and the hope of the world. I say to you that U.S. participation in the Vietnam War is a betrayal of that dream and a mockery of that hope. U.S. participation in the Vietnam War must be ended, and the time to end it is now.
Our first speaker this morning is Mr. John Dooley, who has spent some considerable time in the Far East and will speak to us on the topic of the American presence in Asia, some impressions.
Today is a very important day in your life and mine and in the life of this nation. It is a day in which we celebrate our heritage of freedom of speech and assembly, a day in which we are honoring our nation and that for which it stands by responsibly exercising that freedom. We also are honoring our nation, indicating by our involvement in the events of this day that we care deeply for her and believe that she has great strength, strength enough to correct her own errors and mistakes. It is not a sign of weakness to admit that you are wrong and to seek actions to correct those wrongs. It is only a sign of weakness if you persist in a wrong course, being unwilling to admit that you are headed in a wrong way. America is not weak, but strong. She can admit where she is wrong and correct herself. It is easy to find fault with one's country, and we have had a great amount of that of late. So much so, in fact, that we have ignored the good and positive elements in our tradition and our heritage. We need to recover desperately a positive appreciation for the strengths of our people and our tradition. Our assembly here today and the free and open expression of our discontent with the present foreign policy of our government is a positive expression of our love and concern for our country. It is in this spirit that I wish to share today with you some impressions which I received in a portion of Southeast Asia, impressions of the impact of American presence there. It was my privilege in 1966 and 7 to serve as a consultant in higher education with the Presbyterian Church of Formosa in the Republic of China in Taiwan. This was a rare privilege because most Americans who go to the Republic of China are related to agencies and institutions in which the leadership roles are held by members of the government of Chiang Kai-shek. My relationships while there were with the Taiwanese, rather than the mainland or nationalist Chinese. I was able to view our presence there from the underside of that society. Taiwan is an island of about 125 miles off the coast of China. It is approximately 250 miles north to south and about 90 miles east to west. 10 million Taiwanese reside there. They are a people whose ancestors have been born there since the 17th century and who lived under Japanese colonial rule from 1895 to 1945 in the hope and anticipation of being reunited to China. When in 1945, following the defeat of Japan, the nationalist Chinese came, aboard American troop transports, by the way, the Taiwanese looked forward to being received by the Chinese as a long-lost relative. They were not. Taiwan was plundered and looted as if it were a war prize. The first contingent of Chiang Kai-shek's people came to Taiwan in 1945 with General Chen Yi as the appointed governor of the island. 2 years later, in February of 1947, when the resentment of the Taiwanese was at the flashpoint, Taiwanese were resenting the looting and the pillage and the rape of their country by soldiers, officers, and government officials. Yet they kept hoping for and looking for the United Nations or the United States to intercede on their behalf against this oppressive regime, but no one ever did. Finally, a delegation of Formosan youth presented a petition to the American consulate in Taipei, requesting that the United States intercede with Chiang Kai-shek, get him to replace Governor Chen Yi and reform that corrupt administration. The reply which these young people in Formosa received from the American consulate was this: "This is China now." This reply was given even though the repressive and corrupt nature of Governor Chen Yi's administration was abundantly clear, and despite the fact that no formal decision had been made, or as yet, in fact, has been made, as to what the final disposition of Formosa should be. In the peace treaty with Japan, the only provision made was that Japan would give up Formosa and the Pescadores. Nothing was stated about the present or future status of Taiwan. And this is as yet to be determined by the United Nations. In 1947, the Taiwanese were not asking for independence. They were asking for a fair and just administration of their country by the Allies until such time as a determination could be made as to their fate. In the face of extensive looting at every level of government, to the extent of destroying the economic base of the country, tearing down telephone lines, ripping up water pipes, railway rails, and shipping them to Shanghai to be sold for personal gain, in the face of this pillage and the brutal violence against the unarmed populace in which the whole of the intellectual and professional leadership was systematically rounded up and killed in March of 1947, in the face of this, we made not the slightest objection. We allowed a people who looked to us as the source and the champions of liberty and self-determination, a people who looked to us as their source of hope after 50 years of domination by the Japanese, we allowed these people to come under the repressive domination of a government which was not legally established, that gives lip service to democracy but denies it at every turn in Taiwan. This repressive domination in Taiwan is manifest in every aspect of life. Academic freedom is severely limited, if it exists at all. That is, scholarship must not conflict with national policy. In every school and university and college, there is a political officer whose responsibility it is to check out lectures to make sure that they are not in conflict with national policy or critical of the government, and to supervise student activities so that they also are prevented from being in any way in conflict with national policy or critical. Martial law has been in effect in Taiwan since 1947, which means that citizens do not have any protection by the courts. Men can be and are arrested and sentenced without any due process. The sedition laws are very vague and applied liberally to squelch all criticism. Censorship of the press and all media, as well as mail, is very tightly maintained. There are political officers in every agency and among the police, as well as a vast number of paid informers who form a network of thought control. The important decisions affecting Taiwan are made at the national level by the central government, which is made up almost exclusively of mainland Chinese. Only 18 out of 1,500 members of the National Assembly are Taiwanese. The members of the legislative and control yuans were elected on the mainland in 1947 by provinces and remain in office until they die, and then they're not replaced. No opposition party is allowed, and non-party candidates for local offices, county and provincial, are discouraged from running by threats and arrests. Candidates for local office have only a 10-day period in which to criticize the government, and too severe a criticism may result in imprisonment. Unions are forbidden to strike, and neither the unions nor the government inform the workers as to what their rights are under the law. Present unions are controlled by the government, and no new unions can be formed. Our present foreign policy continues to support these denials of the best in our tradition. This is done on the excuse that to do anything else would be to meddle in the internal affairs of another country. And yet it has not as yet been decided what the fate of Formosa shall be, and our continued support of Chiang Kai-shek is meddling in the worst sense. There is another impression that came to me very clearly during my time in Taiwan. We as Americans find it very difficult to step outside of our Western civilization and tradition and understand and accept another culture. We tend to condemn it and participate in its destruction without understanding it. Our criticism is not always open and direct or even conscious, but it is very strong and pervasive because of our money and our power. The difficulty we have is best illustrated by the experience of the church. It has been massively unsuccessful in Asia because the church as a Western institution cannot or will not divest itself of its Western trappings sufficiently to enter into the life of an Asian people. It unconsciously sought first to westernize the people there before allowing them to become part of the community of faith. India, by contrast, gave Buddhism to China, and she did with it what she wished and made it her own. We in the West seem to feel that people must be remade in our image before they can receive the benefits of our society. We consciously or unconsciously impose the behavior patterns of our society and the technological revolution on people as a condition of their receiving anything from us. We don't even seem ready to listen or to learn. We seem to have no awareness that civilizations which are more ancient than our own have something to teach us and something in their tradition worth preserving against the onslaught of Western technology. American technology has come to Taiwan. Mass production and manufacturing have developed remarkably. Taiwan has the second highest standard of living in Southeast Asia, but the traditionally strong extended family is breaking up. Young people are crowding into the urban centers of that country from farms and are set adrift in a strange and hostile environment. The stability of the society and its customs of respect and honor are being undermined. The technological revolution is destroying the fabric of the society. Those who are the bearers of that technology don't even attempt to understand what is happening and what it is that is being destroyed, much less to ask any questions about whether it should be destroyed or not. Another impression has to do with the brain drain. The eagerness with which young people in Taiwan seek to learn English is welcomed by most Americans as an indication of the love which Taiwanese have for America. It is easy and comfortable to make this assumption, but a tragic misreading of the situation. The truth of the matter is not that they love America, but they are seeking an escape route from Taiwan. This is the predominant and primary concern of all young people who are in college or in universities, whether they are Taiwanese or the sons or daughters of mainlanders. None of the young people of that country are excited about its future or are willing to invest themselves in the task of nation building. For the descendants of the mainlanders, Taiwan is not their home, and they have no concern for its future or sense of responsibility for its development. For Taiwanese young people, there is no hope of a future in Taiwan. They presently have no significant say about anything in Taiwan and see no hope for any in the future. There is a saying among young people in Taiwan which expresses this feeling with great power. It is this: to graduate is to be unemployed. Their answer is to do everything in their power to flee that country and to start a new life elsewhere, principally in the United States. Every year, 2,000 of the brightest young men and women with college and university degrees leave Taiwan for advanced study abroad. 97% of them do not return. We've not only allowed and encouraged the repressive conditions to develop in that country by our foreign policy, but we are pumping their most precious and valuable resource right out of that land into our own. My impressions were that we are supporting an undemocratic and repressive regime and preventing self-determination from being expressed in that particular country. We tend, through our uncritical promotion of technology, to destroy those whom we would help. And we are receiving from Taiwan its most valued and precious natural resource, its educated young people. It seemed to me in my time there that we need to ask ourselves if this is what we really want to be doing in that part of the world. I don't think it is.
Our next speaker is Dr. Harold Johnson, Professor of Political Science in Justin Morrill College. He'll speak on the topic Self-Determination for Southeast Asia, Some Problems and Prospects. Dr. Johnson.
In a few minutes at my discretion, I hasten first to indicate that whereas the title of my remarks is addressed to the situation in the Far East, I lay no claim at being an expert on Southeast Asian affairs. Neither am I desirous initially in taking a position on certain aspects of the problem which confronts us. This does not mean that I do not feel strongly on certain issues and that I am not prepared, as a member of our panel, to confront them on the basis of criteria which have special meaning to me. I am dedicated to the peaceful settlement of disputes. I have lost at least one colleague in the Vietnam situation, a colleague who stood openly in opposition to United States policy in its early phase. And I have witnessed a student whom I continue to hold in high respect choose to spend 5 years in prison rather than to fight for a cause with which he could not identify. What I prefer to do in these preliminary remarks is to clarify a few misconceptions in an area where I do confess to have credentials, namely in an understanding of various aspects of the concept of self-determination. This is of special relevance in any projected analysis of the Vietnam problem, since it is basically in its name that so many factions have professed to be legitimate. In its simplest form, self-determination means that a people shall be in control of their own destiny. This is two-edged, in that it implies both that a people, however identified, shall be free from outside interference, subjugation, or domination, and that they shall be allowed internally to evolve a consensus which will guide their course as a unit. These are in no means necessarily compatible, for it may on occasion suggest that freedom from outside intervention does not assure an open system internally. In fact, in the case of certain territories, it has been claimed by an increasing number of states that liberation of oppressed groups with competing ideologies requires external assistance. Anti-colonial states have advocated international intervention in Southwest Africa, Rhodesia, and the Portuguese overseas territories. The Soviet Union has supported national liberation movements in the name of communist ideology. The Western powers have challenged the grip of Moscow-dominated communist parties in Eastern Europe throughout a portion of their existence. The International Covenants on Human Rights themselves define self-determination as the right of peoples to determine their status and pursue their economic, social, and cultural development without foreign interference. Wherever any people may claim to have been denied such a status, not only is there a motive to recognize it for them, but to create the circumstances which will induce its implementation. We cannot dispute the intent of the concept, but in practice, it often results in the clash of more than one people claiming jurisdiction over the same territory, and the right to speak on behalf of that territory and the people therein. And as an axiom, the concept gives each a right, or so they may claim. Thus we may conclude that people do indeed have a right of self-determination, but as to just who they are and as to the extent of their claim, the issue remains open. The United States has based its moral position in Vietnam on a principle of self-determination for the South Vietnamese people. To the United States, and indeed this is high-sounding, these people should have no less than a right to govern their own affairs without the interference of outside interests. This has often meant that the United States accepts South Vietnam as an independent state in which the government rests on the consent of its people. This has also tended to mean that this consent can be guaranteed only if South Vietnam remains a separate state. If this remains the American position, no alternative to our current support of the South Vietnamese government and perhaps our military presence would seem evident. The South Vietnamese are themselves quick to accept a principle of self-determination which will assume both independence and the continuance of the present government, which would remain immune from any external pressure for change, including pressure from the United States. The North Vietnamese, on the other hand, claim that self-determination for the Vietnamese people was earned for them in 1954, assuring them a status as a single territory to be governed by a government resulting from general elections throughout. To them, American presence is an intervention in their domestic affairs, a violation of their national sovereignty.